I would like to introduce our speaker, Adam T.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will hand you your coffee whenever you're ready.
My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Adam.
I want to thank the committee. Thank you for inviting me to come talk tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Welcome to people that are new. You know, if you're trying AA again, if you don't want to be here tonight, if you don't think this will work for you, sorry it's come to this. I mean, geez. I didn't get to AA because I had a bad weekend. I had a couple of bad decades. And for me, like a lot of us, eventually this becomes a matter of life and death. I mean, every meeting has their perpetual newcomer ship, you know, that guy that walks through the rooms, the lost soul, and that was me. I live on the west side. I stood up in AA for 17 years as a newcomer, and I had so many chips and key tags. We know the drill, right? Could have played poker with them. You know, I remember one secretary saying, give them back. And I did that walk of shame over and over and over again. And looking back at that experience now, I thank God for the unconditional love of the old-timers. A lot of the old-timers, even in this area, that aren't with us anymore, like Joe G and all those guys that I met like over 30-something years ago. And, you know, I remember them saying stuff to me like, don't even bother taking chips. Just sit in the back. Shut up. No, but in a loving way, right? But they made it really clear to me, and if you're new, I hope you hear this. They made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, because somehow those old timers, they could see it. They could see it by my demeanor. They could see it by my lack of interest. They could see it by my fidgety nature. They had the wisdom to see just by my attitude that maybe it wasn't right now. But those old timers made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous would always be open to a drunk like me. And I think, looking back at that experience now, if you're new, next to my parents, Alcoholics Anonymous is the closest thing to unconditional love that a drunk like me will ever experience. No matter how many people I burned, how many lives I destroyed, how many cars I wrecked, how many hearts I broke, how many jobs I lost, how many despicable, shameful things I did. And if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, it's the most shameful thing in the world to be the family drunk. Especially if you come from a large family like I do. My mom had three sisters and a brother. My dad had three brothers and a sister. And I mean, she told them everything. One more rubber room, one more overdose, you know, one more car accident. Happy birthday, Dad, I'm in jail. I mean, gosh, does anybody here relate to being paid not to come home on the holidays? Oh, it was like that thing. I knew I'd get that $500, come back in January. Because they knew I'd steal their friends' cars. I mean, let me in that house full of people with gifts. It's over. I would destroy it. I destroyed her. I destroyed that family. And if you're new, I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it through the lens of Al-Anon. For at least the first decade of my recovery, that thing about, oh, I'm only hurting myself. I had no idea. My mom and dad were, you know, they were great people. They loved me. I was a straight-A student. I was the top of all my classes. I was an only child. And I look now at all the hope and expectation. If you have kids, you know that kind of hope that parents have. You see it outside the elementary schools lined up. I mean, they'll kill you if you get in their way, right? And to watch my mom and dad, to literally watch those two souls watch me burn my life to the ground. To the point where eventually I had drove her so hard in that direction that eventually she had moved, she sold the family property, she did not leave a forwarding address. That's where I left my mom. They were married 50 years. And despite all of that, that high price we pay for this almost despicable low quality of life, the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous has always been open to people like me, people like us. If I lived to be 100 years old, I could never pay AA back for the love and kindness. So you know what? Some of you people have shown me. Not all. I mean, come on. Hey, let's get honest here. If you like everybody in AA, you know what it means, right? It means you're not going to enough meetings. Yeah. My sponsor said you don't really have to like anyone in particular, but if you go through the steps and the traditions, you'll learn to love people here you don't even like. People that are annoying, people that are sarcastic, people that are difficult, right? I mean, there's people that, like, you know, I just can't be in the room with, but when I see that guy at 7-Eleven pissing in his pants loaded, my heart still breaks for him. If I've learned anything in 26 and a half years sober, it's compassion for my fellow man. This is not the hotbed of mental health. You know, we think that narcissism is a choice. I mean, come on. I've learned how to not take things personally. He pet a lion, it's got a thorn in its side. Of course the lion's going to bite you. Every human being has a hidden thorn. Is it my job to point it out or to pull it out? Or is it my job to live by example? To be kind and helpful and supportive. I learned that here. You know, what happened to me eventually is, and we never see this anymore, but I started coming to meetings drunk. Now, the interesting thing about AA 2024, if you actually see a drunk person in a nice place like this these days, people say stuff like, oh my gosh, what's he doing here? It's ironic, right? How quickly we get well. But you don't see a lot of wet alcoholics in AA. And I don't want to bash the therapeutic community. I saw the druggy buggy outside. You know, they're usually sitting in the back. But for me, treatment would swoop me up in my most desperate moments, right? Throw me into yoga class. I'm doing the downward dog. Like, really? Craft hour. Come on, I'm making belt buckles and bongs, right? Please. Nature walks. First chance I get, I'm walking to 7-Eleven, getting a big gulp cup, filling it up with liquor, putting a little Coke on top, walking into the late night candlelight meeting, doing some of my best sharing. You know, then I started going through treatment centers. By the way, has anybody read the chapter to wives? I never read it. I never had a wife. Not of my very own. I just want to stir it up for the Aladons. I know. Talk to your sponsor. But it's interesting because the chapter to wives talks about four types, and it's an illustration, right? Magic, medicine, misery, sound familiar, fun with problems, just problems. It describes four types of alcoholics. And the fourth type of alcoholic that's described in the chapter to wives is the type of alcoholic that's been placed in one institution after another. Sound familiar? Type of alcoholic that typically drinks on his way home from the hospital, right? And in the 17 years that I recycled through Alcoholics Anonymous, albeit in one of the largest AA groups in the world, I still became that fourth type. By the time I finally got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd gone through residential treatment for alcoholism 28 times. Right, not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood, right? 28 consecutive times, and I'm wearing that like some kind of badge of honor. I'm thinking, that's what makes me an alcoholic. And I remember telling my late sponsor, you know, I went through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would, like, get rid of the guy, you know, loser. Go find someone that's willing. You know, one of those overzealous sponsors chasing me around. Didn't want to ruin his batting average. And I told him I went through treatment 28 times. He starts laughing and he says, Adam, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, oh no, that just means you paid $500,000 for a big book. And I didn't think that was funny. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book. But page 101 of the big book says, any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run. Treatment has its rightful place in recovery. Even Bill Wilson had gone through treatment. Treatment probably saved my life. If you wonder what all the treatment centers and religions have in common, it's very simple. They all send their drunks to us. Mm-hmm. Some people don't go through treatment. It's not a prerequisite for AA. But my experience after all of that is that treatment never solved the problem. And as an alcoholic, like a lot of us, I always thought the problem was alcohol. I thought it was liquor. And I remember someone in Alcoholics Anonymous saying to me, Adam, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, that little glass of Chardonnay, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then in the very next breath, he says to me, and if you are in fact an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem isn't alcohol. And I'm like, what? It went right over my head. It took another decade for me to understand the impact of that statement. It was like some kind of cruel riddle. I drank over that for years. But what happened to me, and you'll hear that a lot, what happened? What happened to me is I got around a group of big book enthusiasts, literalists, people in Alcoholics Anonymous that took the statements in the big book, turned them into questions, directed the questions at me. Very simple ideas, like the Socratic method. Was I incapable of being honest with myself? Did I in fact drink because I liked the effect produced by alcohol? Well, duh, that's a no-brainer, right? How about this? Was I restless, irritable, and discontent by nature? Was that my natural state before my lips ever touched alcohol? What a powerful question. Was my greatest obsession that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy my drinking at the same time? And the last piece, the more important thing, did I pursue that illusion to the gates of insanity and death? And what happened to me as I went through those considerations, if you're like me, is that for the first time I saw the truth. The most obvious truth, what we call the external unmanageability, was crystal clear. From the time I was in middle school, I was in eighth grade, I was already pissing in my pants. I was already drooling on my desk. I was already passed out under the bleachers. I overshot the mark from the first time I drank. My nickname in eighth grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. People were picking high schools, I was already picking rehabs. But if you're new tonight, alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or six packs or 12 packs or kegs or shot glasses or little fancy glasses of wine. Alcoholism comes in people. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson describes it, centering in my mind, if going through the considerations in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous shows me anything at all, it shows me that an alcoholic of my type, an alcoholic of this type, cannot really live without alcohol. Not successfully, not happily. And part of what it really means for me to be an alcoholic, if I'm honest about my relationship with liquor, is that I seem to have this mind that will consistently take me back to that first drink. Every time I get released from an emergency room, a hospital, right, a fancy Malibu treatment center, Men's Central Jail, 5743, roll it up. It's amazing to me. I'm sitting in county jail, right? Countless times. 9500 Twin Towers, right? I'm sitting in that cell, casually reading a novel, not a cloud on the horizon. And I hear that number, 5743, roll it up. And suddenly, there's this visceral compulsion in me that is so powerful that no matter how long I've been locked up, I can't even stop at the release module for my property. Does this not sound familiar? As soon as I hear that number, and I know people mean well, and I come to AA, and I hear people say, well, don't drink no matter what. Like, what? I mean, not that I'm literate, but I did read the book. I'm like, what happened to the top of page 24 where it says verbatim, every alcoholic passes through this state where even the strongest desire is of absolutely no avail. It says for someone like me, my willpower will become virtually non-existent. So I know people being well. And for a lot of people, they're powerless over the second drink, but not the first. But I got a car outside with no brakes. I can't stop myself from getting in that car. I know that car's got no brakes. I know that if I get in that car, I'm going to hit a treatment center. I'm going to hit an emergency room. I'm going to hit a police car. That's what it means to be powerless over that second idea. But what it's saying is something very different. That I have no effective mental against the first one. That I can't stay out of that car. I'm going to sit in that car and start playing around with the idea of all the places I might go if I just start that ignition. That somehow treatment or therapy or medication is going to put brakes in that car is delusional. And when I hear people say, don't drink no matter what, there's got to be a translation for a drunk like me. Go to meetings no matter what. Work steps no matter what. Maintain commitments no matter what. Be of service no matter what. Develop this discipline of steps 10, 11, and 12, which is peace, power, and purpose respectively. And what the doctor's opinion said is so true. It says, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand. It says, once a psychic change has occurred in this person who seemed absolutely doomed, he is suddenly easily able to control his desire for alcohol. What a powerful thing this is. If you're new and you don't believe in life after death, you're looking at it. And some of us know that without a doubt. That had it not been for divine intervention, this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. What you read today was such a powerful thing. There used to be a story about the Eskimo. Anybody's heard about the Eskimo in AA? That comes from the story of a priest and an atheist, and they're in a bar in Alaska. And the priest says to the atheist, why don't you believe in God? And the atheist says, well, I tried God once. And the priest says, well, what do you mean? And the atheist says, well, I was lost in a blizzard. I was out in the snow, in the tundra, pitch black night. And it was a blizzard. And I got on my knees. I knew I was going to die. So I got on my knees and I said, God, if there's a God, help me. I'm going to die. And the priest looks at him and he says, well, you must believe you're here. And the atheist says, you don't understand. Right after I got off my knees, I bumped into this Eskimo and he showed me the way back into town. Welcome to the igloo, guys. I didn't recognize it. I didn't recognize the divine intervention that this is. That this is friendly direction that points to a power that will solve my spiritual problem. This self-centered fear that is driving me. It'll catapult me into a completely new way of living. But I was resistant to that. What it really means to be an alcoholic is I seem to have this mind that continues to take me back to that drink. It's almost like my default program, like on a computer. And I live in Santa Monica. Now it's called Silicon Beach. That's a new name for Santa Monica. We've got Yahoo, Snapchat, Google, all the great, you know, tech companies are there. And a lot of the guys that work in those companies are very smart, right? They program computers, they build apps, a lot of them are engineers. Here's some math for the smart people. Potential plus alcoholism equals zero. It's like the quadratic formula. We all know that, right? But, you know, we talk about the language that Bill Wilson uses in 1939 and how advanced it was. Because today we use the word program all the time. It's common vernacular. One of the definitions of the word program, if you look it up in the dictionary, very simple. A sequential set of instructions, right? Designed to do what? Bring about a result. Now listen to the parallel language. What do you do when you get a corrupt file on a computer? Well, it's obvious. You install a recovery disk. And the function of that disk is to restore that program to an earlier point in the process. Second step, the original self, the self that's not corrupted by fear or selfishness or resentment. The self that's not corrupted by the lies I tell myself, that inner narrative. It never occurred to me that 10 and 11 become like the viral scan. That if I follow some very simple instructions, for someone like me, what happens when I get to 10 is I become mindful. I become accountable. For the first time in my life, I can become transparent with a spiritual advisor or a sponsor. All of a sudden, I'm able to see where I paint the red flags green. Preemptively, I'm able to navigate around the drama, be able to match calamity with serenity, be able to bookend my day. What a powerful thing that is for people like us. You know, we talk about, oh, I'm powerless over everything. I don't buy that. You know, we were talking about this thing about our thinking. There's this great thing in this treatment center. I do talks in it. We do H&I, and it's on the wall. It says, watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become your character. Watch your character, it becomes your destiny. And we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, my thought life will be placed on a higher plane when it's separated or divorced from wrong motives. If my motive is selfishness and self-centeredness, you don't think the outcome is going to be the same? How dare I think I can plant corn and harvest potatoes? It's like, I mean, at some point I had to become responsible for these ideas. It never occurred to me when Wilson talks about principles before personalities. It seems that our founder's future hope was that these spiritual instructions, these guidelines, would have more impact than the fellowship. And I love the fellowship. I love the meetings, the weddings, the birthdays, going to Denny's, all the wonderful things that we do. But it talks about it in the book that it's one element in the powerful cement that binds us. For me, the fellowship gives me enthusiasm. It gives me inspiration. It gives me encouragement, hope, brotherly love. Some people actually find relationships and employment here, right? But if you unleash a character like me into a large group of people like this without guiding principles, you know what happens? My character defects thrive. Consciously or subconsciously, without guiding principles, I actually get sicker in a big group of people like this. And what that looks like, if you're new, is consciously or subconsciously, I start to become more separate, more different, and more alone. And if you haven't heard that terminology, what it actually means is separated from God, different than every single person here. I think we call that terminal uniqueness, right? And alone. You know that loneliness, that ache in the heart of every one of us that really has nothing to do with the proximity or closeness of other people? That loneliness, right here, right now, the bigger the crowd, the more alone I am. My own birthday, my own wedding, that thing inside me. And if you have that like I do, what that is my inability to connect. And you put a couple drinks in me, I'm calling people from fifth grade saying, I love you. Oh my God, I go right into amends. Get me loaded, put a couple drinks on me. I'm standing on the roof of my building howling at the moon. I'm at one with the universe. Not, don't relate. Couple more drinks, I'm okay with me. Get me good and drunk, I lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows. Right? Drunk dialing at 3 in the morning. Come on. It's like alcohol does so much for me. I don't care what it's doing to me. Think about it. Alcohol is classified by the AMA as a depressant. 9 out of 10 people, they have a couple drinks and they're like, oh my gosh, I gotta slow down. I'm feeling it. I have work tomorrow. I have a couple drinks and honey, I want to get married. Right? I want to go to Vegas tonight. I'm trying to find the car keys I hid for myself before the first drink. Oh, you never done that? I've done all that. Including like hiding the crack, right? Yeah. That insanity. See, for me, alcohol is a stimulant. It does something for me that overshadows everything it does to me. And that's what the Al-Anons can't figure out about us. No offense, they can't figure out why we drink. We can't figure out why you don't. And I thought for years, because I drink, therefore my life's unmanageable. And in reality, that's like looking at the tip of an iceberg and seeing the ruined marriage, broken home, financial destitution, the failing health, and thinking that's a problem. In fact, that's what treatment told me the problem was. That's why I was sitting in another fancy treatment center in my nightgown learning about my triggers. I'm like, excuse me, counselor, wait a second. Waking up's a trigger for me. I'm awake. Like, sir, will you please go back to your dorm, button up your nightgown, and see what AA is saying is something very different. AA is suggesting that the trigger for me is actually on the inside. You ever notice when an alcoholic's not having a good day? It's when I'm not getting my way. Oh, come on. We're all like 5-year-old kids here with old people's faces. Oh, really? You don't believe it? Cross one of us. I'll resent you for decades. And your grandkids. The problem is, if you're new, the resentment in Latin means to refeel. Again, consciously or subconsciously, I've taken an event from my past, I've attached an emotion to it, then I refeel it, I recreate it, I replay it, I re-engage in it. My life becomes like spiritual Groundhog Day, and I don't even see it. And it talks about, unless I can experience an entire psychic change, meaning a complete shift in my perception, it says there's virtually no hope for my recovery. This is strong language. This is a fatal disease. What it really means to be an alcoholic. And right next to being separate, different, and alone, there's 3 fundamental ideas in my life. The first is to be protected by some kind of God. The second, to be accepted by self. The third, to be connected to a community. Protected by God, which in a way is almost like if I go to the ocean with a cup, I get a couple of water. What if I go to the ocean with my whole life? God, take all of me. My resentment, my fear, my selfishness. It sounds passive, but it's not. It's about alignment. I had to see that. Like the first 3 ideas in a vision for you. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. 1 through 3. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. 4 through 7. Right? Clear away the wreckage of your past. You think I can abandon a ship and climb back on? And you hear it in every meeting. It's almost like we go into this kind of like unconscious zone. But it says we ask for His care and protection with what? Complete abandon. First piece. The second piece, to be accepted by self. In 4 through 7, if I continue on that journey, I develop what's called an internal locus of control. We were talking about it at dinner. That means I don't need internal or external validation. I develop this center. And the third piece, to be connected to a community. Imagine, protected by God, accepted by self, connected to a community, and I go from being the weakest link in my family, and like all of us, in Native American, this idea, we're generations of dysfunction. That's what I bring here, generations of it. And to go from being the weakest link in my family, a family where my mom's brother committed suicide drunk, my father's brother committed suicide drunk, I come from a long line of suicide, mental illness, and alcoholism, and to be 26 and a half years away from that, and now be the strongest link in that family? Alcoholics Anonymous, this idea of alcoholism is the only disease, when treated, that will actually leave the sufferer in a better position than if they never had the disease. I'd have never believed it. And I got around some of these big book literalists. And I remember he said to me, how free do you want to be? You want to be free enough to just survive this? So you can kick the dog and run around playing victim? And when people say, how you doing? I'm hanging in there. And it was rough. I mean, he was hard on me. He said, do you want to be free enough to chase your dreams? Free enough to have relationships that work? Free enough to navigate around the drama? To be able to stay in some kind of fit spiritual condition? To have a center of peace and power and purpose? And I got excited about it. It was almost like salesmanship, but I saw people that lived like that. He said true strength was gentleness. What a weird concept, because I'd live in a place of fear all of my life and I didn't even know it. That I was driven by self-centered fear and I couldn't see it. I always went to what if. And to be in a place now where I got separated from that. And I look back at 17 years of failure in probably, again, one of these really big groups, and I look back, if you're new, and it was my defiance towards spiritual principles. In the original manuscript, we've all heard it, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail that's thoroughly followed our directions. It doesn't say path. And if you're like me, I don't like directions. I don't even like being told not to do something I already don't want to do. Sound familiar? I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. Oh, and then I'll blame you for eternity. That's why we say denial is an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Oh, come on. Think about it. You can tell an alcoholic. You can't tell him much. You don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. Right? And what that means is you could lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. And when we talk about attraction rather than promotion in the 11th tradition, what that really means to a drunk like me is eventually I'm going to come back to AA on my own terms. Not because Sober Living wants me to, not because my parole officer wants me to, not because DCSF thinks it's a good idea. I mean, where I live on the West Side, they all get sober for the trust fund, right? But if you're like me, not to be divisive, but hope doesn't matter to a drunk like me until I'm hopeless. You think hope matters to me when I got $1 million left in the bank, brand new truck, little boat down in the marina? You wouldn't catch me dead in an AA meeting. And my experience, if you're new, is that God didn't mean anything to me. God didn't mean a single thing to me until my back was against the wall. And what happened to me, not gutter bravado, I got shot in a little argument, went right through me. And I'm conscious, I'm laying on the gurney, I got the paramedics over me with the little paddles. You know what? All I know is God. You ever been in a situation like that where you're faced with your mortality? There's only one thing people cry for. Mommy and God. Right? You got your head in the toilet every morning, puking your guts. Anybody had the dry heaves? I mean, come on, who prays more than drunks like us? That's all I'm saying is, oh God, please help me. Right? And it's so interesting because, you know, Bill Wilson has this powerful white light experience. And on the very next page, it says it was quickly blotted out by worldly clamors, most of which were where? Within himself. So I'm sitting in the cardiologist's office in the ER, and he stuck a tampon right through me. That's the way they deal with gunshots. And he does an angiogram where he runs this cord through my groin. He pumps a dye through my chest on the TV, and he looks at me and he smiles and he says, the bullet missed. You're going to be fine. Now, 1 second ago, I'd seen nursery school to that day pass before my eyes in like 3 seconds. I'm like, oh, what I wouldn't give to say goodbye to my poor mother. You know, like, and then the very next thought was, I need to get out of this hospital before law enforcement shows up, and where's my drink?
Yep.
That quick. So the moral of that story, if you're new, is there's a huge difference between the act of surrender that gets a newcomer into AA over and over and over again, and the state of surrender that's keeping the old timers here. It's a completely different concept. And she just said it. Humility plus service equals gratitude. How do I stay in a posture of gratitude? The only way I can do it is by working with people. I've tried everything else. Nothing ensures immunity for an intensive work with others. Immunity from not only that first drink, but for the insanity and the bondage of self. What a simple idea. Into me. Intimacy is into me I see. This thing that we do. For us, it might just be sitting and reading the doctor's opinion to somebody. And if you read the doctor's opinion, don't worry about it. By the time you get to Bill's story, they'll have a relationship. By the time they get to there is a solution, they'll have a career. And by the time you get to more about alcoholism, they won't need AA. I mean, the number of people that come here, like we all know, if everyone came to Alcoholics Anonymous State, this convention would be 3,000-4,000 people. Right? So what happens? The further I get away from that drink, the more difficult this becomes. And I didn't understand. There's a word called purgatory. And you know what it actually means? To be caught between two worlds. In AA, here's the world. I can't live out there drunk anymore because it's just too painful, but I can't be sober and happy because I'm unwilling to let go of my old ideas. I have a coin that says the greatest battle in a man's life is not against his brother or sister, it is against himself. So what is it that's stopping me from having an amazing life? From chasing my dreams? This becomes the idea. You tell a 5-year-old kid, go in your room and straighten out your room. He doesn't want to do it. Tell that same young man, go in your room, throw out all your old stuff, we'll buy you new stuff. How long would that take? So I would challenge everybody in here, if you haven't gone through this process, to ask yourself what it is. Because that what was asked of me. What was it that's blocking me? And I became teachable. Thank God, by the way, we don't look like our stories, right? So what happened to me is I got to one more treatment center, 120 pounds, dying of alcoholism, stunk like urine. You know how we look, right? A vision for you. You know, and I'm sitting in the detox with my ass hanging out in my nightgown, judging the speaker. I mean, it's so funny how we're the only people that could be on the curb and still look down at the world. Right? Come on, I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. I'm strutting around the detox bragging about robbing Brink's trucks. I finally did my 4-step. It was a bread truck. I know. It was empty. It was empty. So I'm sitting in the treatment center with my fellow associates. And this woman, I'm so arrogant, right? I don't realize I'm homeless, okay? Because it's a nice place. And this woman comes in on an H&I panel. As we all know, it stands for hospitals and institutions. It's a committee that brings meetings into prisons, detoxes, treatment centers, hospitals. Our H&I on the west side is almost as big as this. Second Monday of the month. And these people are fighting each other to get on panels to talk to people that don't care. I know. But H&I probably has one of the lowest relapse rates in all of recovery. If you're new, we'll help you. We will help you get to H&I. We will show you what we've done. What do we mean and what do we do? It's in the book. We'll show you. So this woman's on this panel. She's doing her talk. We're in the audience. At the end of her talk, she looks us all up and down and she says, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And I looked at her, I looked at the guy next to me, and I said, what a bitch. And then she said something that would later change my life. She said, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery, the reason I wouldn't give it to you is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And if you're new, that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender that each and every alcoholic has to walk, it's personal. We can't give that to you. Again, not to be divisive, but if you were in a hot tub with a supermodel, fifth of whiskey, eight ball, daddy sends you to rehab, we don't expect you to be happy. Anybody ever get interrupted in the middle of, like, you know, a fifth of whiskey? It's awful. I mean, come on. We see these high-speed pursuits every day on TV. The guy's sitting there in the car for like 2 hours. And the cops are like, what do you think he's doing, Bob? We know what he's doing. He's got an eight ball and a fifth of whiskey. He's going to finish before he goes to jail. Come on. Like, are you kidding me? Anybody drink on their way to treatment? Every time. Every time. And I felt great walking in. Oh, I felt so good walking in. And then it starts to just come down a little bit. And I'll, do I really got to do this today? AMA. That gift of desperation. What I didn't understand, if you're new, is desperation and hopelessness are not the same thing. I have this men's group. They're like 400 guys every Wednesday, and some guy will get up and he'll say, you know, I got a drunk driving last night. And he'll get a standing ovation. And then he'll say, my wife broke my nose with a frying pan. Another standing ovation. He's got it all patched up. And then he says, and I got a promotion at work. And everyone's like, oh, no. You see? Because sometimes what's worse than bad luck in early recovery is good luck. And I had to see that. Desperation can be fixed. You know what fixes desperation? $10,000. Write a newcomer a $10,000 check. See if he'll be at the meeting tomorrow. Never. Hopelessness. Being in a million-dollar house in Newport Beach on a piss-soaked mattress. Knowing the next drink is probably going to kill me. And knowing I can't stop myself from doing it. That's hopelessness. And to understand what that meant. There's only three ways people get here. Crisis, intervention, and they just get tired. That last one was the only thing. I got so tired of living like an animal. Chow time, group time, lights out. I mean, it's like even the institutional living. I couldn't take it anymore. And all I had to do was become willing to take actions I didn't believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, and suddenly I would have a door to unlimited freedom. What a beautiful thing this is. You know, a lot of times, I know there's just a little bit of time left, we talk about AA has no evidence-based results. Really? Go to a world convention, right? My friend Trina's here from British Columbia. You probably, half this room can't get in. But if you go to a world convention, I'll tell you, you check out 80,000 alcoholics in a world convention, it's unbelievable. You want to talk about evidence-based results? When they do the out-of-towners, it takes 2.5 hours. Every continent, every country, every city, every township. You can't do that on your insurance. It's effort. You have to make the effort. But for every one of those people that have made that effort, you'll see a son, you'll see a mom, you'll see a beautiful daughter, you'll see a dad, you'll see a world of people that will tell you AA is the most powerful thing in their loved one's life. This little book we talk about is on the top 88 books in the United States Library of Congress that shaped America. It's affected the lives of somewhere between, 30 to 40 million people? And you know why it's not going to work for me? Because it wasn't my idea. Arrogant. Eventually, I got to a place in my life where my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take anymore. That's the progression. You ever seen that kind of drinking? Well, my head can't get enough and my body can't take anymore. God means something totally different. It means grow or die. Now I'm going to be confronted with a fork in my road. This is no longer a choice. My hand's going to be forced. I either go on to the bitter end, as we've all heard, blotting out the consciousness, right, of my intolerable situation, or accept spiritual help. And it talks about, faced with alcoholic destruction or to live on a spiritual basis, these are not easy alternatives. Really? Do a survey at Costco. Jails, institutions, and death. happy, joyous, and free. No brainer. Oh, come on. You step over to my cell in Men's Central Jail, you ask me that question, I'm scratching my head, thinking, how bad an alcoholic death? Can I talk to my counselor, my therapist, my parole officer, my MFT, my attorney, get back to you on Monday? And now I'm justifying, minimizing, and rationalizing my right to drink. And when the doctor's opinion talks about me being in full flight from reality, an outright mental defective, and I argue with that, look at how I defended my right to get loaded. See, the bottom really for a lot of us is the same. From Yale to jail, Park Avenue to Park Bench. Very simple bottom. Twofold. When I ask for help, but more importantly, when I'm actually willing to receive it. Do you know how many people come here looking for help? I'll simplify it. I throw you a life raft, and you're like, I was looking for a blue one. I really don't like the way you threw it, bro. Heartbreaking. How do you work with someone like that? It's so heartbreaking. Acknowledge. In working with others, he didn't use the words like codependency enabling. He didn't use words like boundaries. But if you look at those concepts in working with others, the idea is not to work harder at someone's recovery than they are. So I'll close with a couple ideas. I've been given the 5-minute warning. So if someone did to me what I did to myself, I would have killed them. If someone did to me what I did to others, I would have killed them. And then I come to AA, and you want me to pray to God. I didn't want God to find out where I was. I was bankrupt in those simple relationships. If you look at the steps by design, they remedy those three ideas. 1 through 3 recreates and develops a relationship with God. 4 through 7 recreates and develops a relationship with self. 8 and 9 recreates and develops a relationship with others. Simple idea. 10 maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with self. 11 maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with God. 12 through service maintains, develops, and grows my relationship with others. So coming out of the steps, a selfish, self-centered drunk like me is not only easily able to control my desire for alcohol, it's right in the doctor's opinion, but for the first time in my life, I'm able to live in harmony with God, self, and others. There was a great spiritual teacher. He was asked, what's the most important thing of all your teachings? He said, love God with all thy heart, love thy neighbor as thyself. And if God scares you out of AA and you're a real drunk, don't worry about it. Booze will scare you back in. So in 1 through 3, I give it up. 4 through 7, I clean it up. 8 and 9, I make it up. 10, 11, and 12, I keep it up. Einstein said, I would rather live my life pretending there's a God and finding out there isn't than live my life pretending there's no God and finding out there is. It's Pascal's wager. You can look it up later. It's easier to believe than not to believe. So the last thing, I get to fly a lot, and I don't have a lot to brag about on the outside, but I'll tell you this. I was at LAX. I was waiting for a plane. This kite comes running up to me at the airport. He's wearing a slingshot t-shirt, you know, 3 sizes too small. He's got the tattoo, the whole full body tattoo with the neck thing, got the teardrops, and he rushes me and he's like, you don't remember me, do you, bro? I'm like, I missed a jump back. No, I don't remember you. I mean, like, I was looking for somewhere to... And I thought he was going to hit me up for money. He was really aggressive. But he had these 2 little kids with him. And he had this beautiful lady by his side, and I was completely blindsided. And he said to me, 15 years ago, you spoke on a prison panel, and something you said changed my life. And then he said, these are my beautiful daughters. This is my amazing wife. We want to thank you. And the wife starts crying. This is like yesterday. She starts crying. Now the little kids are crying. No, wait, now I'm crying. We're all crying. A minute ago, I didn't know whether to run, call security, you know, I mean, and now we look like the long-lost family from the old country. I mean, I felt, it was amazing. I actually, my head started to get big. I felt like the Dalai Lama. I had to tell my sponsor. My sponsor's like, Adam, you got a big mouth and a good memory. Don't let it go to your head. Click. He had to ruin my moment. There's 2 dates in a human being's life. The day we're born, the day we find out why. All my life, I thought it was about money, property, and prestige. Job, house, girl, car, different job, different house, bigger house, different girl. But see, puke smells the same in a Mercedes, see? The problem is, if you have what I have, a spiritual disease, how dare I think I could solve a spiritual problem with a physical solution anyway? How arrogant it is. Part of the word spiritual is ritual. The things that we do here. If we do a step workshop, you'll hear the actions that we take change our perception of reality. Mind, body, and spirit. Restless, irritable, and discontent is irritable of the mind, restlessness of the body, discontentment of the spirit. The solution is peace, power, and purpose. The last thing I'm going to say, there's a poem in Notre Dame. It says, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul I could not free. I sought my brother, and I found all three. Thank you.
Thank you.